The field of obstetrics has several thorns in its side, one of which we have covered many times before on this podcast, is preterm birth. But that's not the focus of this episode. No, we're going to focus on another just equally irritating and just as morbid thorn, which is hypertensive disorders in pregnancy. This month, which is February 2024, has seen some news articles and some headlines regarding this that have caused people to go, wait, do we have new developments on preeclampsia and pregnancy and hypertension overall? Well, yes and no. And it's a kind of a complex question here, but this is making the news cycles. For example, the American Heart Association, out of its newsroom, released this article on February the 12th, 2024. The title is Heart Disease Risk Factors in Women Highlight Need for Increased Awareness and Prevention. Well, that's a great title, but we already know that there's women at risk. We already know what we need to do for prevention. So it's interesting that this has called out through the American Heart Association for obstetricians and specifically any healthcare provider who takes care of women postpartum to be on the lookout for hypertensive disorders in pregnancy. You don't say. I mean, we've been doing this. This is, again, one of our thorns in our sides. I find it so interesting that this comes out like, any women's healthcare provider who does obstetrics is going to go, wow, thank you for that. You know what? I think I should pay attention to blood pressure. What? I mean, it's kind of weird. Of course we're paying attention to blood pressure. They also released the AHA, that is the American Heart Association, their Life Essential 8 Facts of how to keep people cardiovascularly healthy. And the 8 things are nothing that's mind-blowing. Stuff that your grandma said. Eat better, be more active, quit tobacco, get healthy sleep, manage weight, control cholesterol, manage blood sugar, and here's what's making the confusion, kind of stirring up the waters regarding pregnancy and postpartum care. Manage blood pressure. Because here's the quote out of the AHA, their 8 essential steps for better cardiovascular health. Here's what it says. Quote, keeping your blood pressure within acceptable ranges can keep you healthier longer. Yeah, you don't say. They go on to say, quote, levels less than 120 over 80 are optimal. High blood pressure is defined as 130 to 139 over 80 to 89. So let's stop there. So this is, of course, following, because this is out of the AHA, this is following their revised guidelines that came out in 2017, stating that stage 1 hypertension is, of course, 130s over the 80s. Now, here's a question. What does stage 1 hypertension actually mean for us during pregnancy? Because there's a lot of changes in pregnancy, and we know what is abnormal, greater than 140 over 90. But are we missing the boat here? Should we be classifying preeclampsia or hypertensive disorders in pregnancy in line with AHA? Now, we've touched on this as well, but we're going to focus on the new data here in a minute. We've covered this many times where, you know, data is kind of gray, it's kind of soft, and even ACOG has a stance on this back in their bulletin on chronic hypertension in pregnancy from 2019. And don't worry, we're going to summarize that very quickly in this episode as well. So here's the question. With all of this attention for high blood pressure in pregnancy, which is correct, we need to focus on this and get a control of this. Should we be waiting until the postpartum interval to implement AHA, or should we incorporate it within pregnancy? There's a lot of new data here, guys, including something that just got accepted and formally published on January the 24th, 2024, just 1 month ago in AJOG MFM, the Pink Journal, which is an expert review on stage 1 chronic hypertension in pregnancy. And that's going to be the main crux of our discussion here, right? That's going to be the main meal that we're all going to feed on in this episode. I haven't had breakfast yet. Did y'all notice how I went immediately to food? That is weird. That's what I get for doing this. My stomach is growling as I'm doing this. Is that subconscious or what? That's totally Freudian that I put in the food thing. All right, so we're going to talk about stage 1 chronic hypertension in pregnancy from the AJOG MFM expert review. And this includes Baha. I mean, oh my gosh, Sabai, George Saad. These are people that I respect, I've looked up to, I consider them far off mentors, even though they're not far off because they're in Texas. Fantastic people. So stage 1 chronic hypertension in pregnancy, AJOG MFM, published January 24, 2024. Should we be looking at this in pregnancy? And where are we with the whole biomarker thing? right? Because biomarkers are big. Remember, we covered that in the previous episode, the Thermos test. But that honestly wasn't to predict who was going to get preeclampsia. See, that's the confusion here. They're working on that as a set. That's a whole other piece of study. No. Those biomarkers right now was to identify who would progress to severe disease once you made the diagnosis. You see the difference? So, yes, that's super helpful too. Now you've got hypertensive disorder, pregnancy / preeclampsia. Let's do this biomarker test and let's see if you're going to get really severe in the next 7 to 10 days. That's okay. That's risk stratification. But the original intent wasn't to find out who was going to get preeclampsia to begin with. Right now we're left with clinical factors. Okay. And ACOG still discusses and still prefers risk-based administration of aspirin based on those risk factors, although some have called for universal application. We've talked about this many, many times. There's got to be like 10 episodes in the recent past in the archive. You can go back to that. All to say is that this thing is moving, and there is new nationally funded research to try to find biomarkers that can predict who's going to get it, not just progress once they receive it. But I want to focus on this issue of stage one chronic hypertension in pregnancy. What does the data show? Should we be incorporating these values into pregnancy? And what does that actually mean for adverse outcome? Should this be just an awareness piece so we can give patient education, keep a closer eye on her, or both? And we're going to talk about that. And of course, we're going to bring in ACOG's practice bulletin from 2019 that has a very clear statement that really hasn't changed at all. So a lot of moving parts here. Let's get into stage one chronic hypertension in pregnancy. Just trying to keep everyone up to date on evidence-based practice because medicine moves real fast. This is Clinical Pearls.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When I say that February 2024 has seen a little uptick on hypertension and pregnancy getting news play, it's legit. I mean, that's not a hyperbole. I mean, look at USA Today under their health section from February the 20th, 2024. February the 20th, 2024. Out of health from USA Today, the title, the headline is, "For a Dangerous Condition Often Detected Late in Pregnancy," well, that's because that's usually when it happens, "Aspirin Could Save Lives." Now, let me just stop there for a minute. And again, I am not trying to throw Cuevas, who is the lead author of this news publication. It's not a medical study. It's a news editorial. I'm not trying to throw him under the bus, right, at all. I mean, great job. It's a very nice editorial in USA Today. My stance is, brother, we've already known that. Is this news? And for a dangerous condition, often detected late in pregnancy, yeah, that's usually when you get preeclampsia. That's my beat. And guys, we do a lot of commentaries. Remember, we did recently something for The Guardian. We've done stuff for Medline and MedPage. I have no beef with those issues at all. It's just that when is your goal to get people to click on it or to give good info? And my thing is it should be both, right? Yes, have a catchy draw to you and provide good evidence. And not that this isn't good evidence, it's just, well, we've already known that. What's new in this publication, in this new editorial? Because it says, whoa, in a condition that happens late in pregnancy, maybe we should be giving aspirin and there's data that aspirin works. You think? Of course there's data that aspirin works. Now, I would have liked the more current debate of should it be the 81/82 milligram? Should it be the 150? What do we do with that? That seems to be much more catchy than, hey, aspirin may help. Yes, we've already known that. We've known that for a long time. But they do make a good point here, is that there are people studying biomarkers. We've got biomarkers for everything. Why not preeclampsia? And we know the likely players here that led to Thermo's FDA approval of its test to try to figure out who would progress once it's done. And the NIH is looking at this. I mean, they do have something together with the Eunice Kennedy Shriver, the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, that division. They are looking for biomarkers in a racially diverse group that can see if they can predict the development of preeclampsia. Okay, so we're not there quite yet, but this is something that's in evolution. It's something that's happening. And whether that's placental growth factor, that's PLGF, whether it's the soluble-like tyrosine kinase 1, whether it's PAP-A, there are different articles that look at different things. Most of them use two or all three of those markers. Okay, placental growth factor, pregnancy-associated plasma protein A, so PLGF or PAP-A, or soluble-like tyrosine kinase 1. And of course, because nothing is free in medicine, we always have to think about, remember, careful what you ask for, right? Okay, hey, you're 10 weeks pregnant, fantastic. Let's do this test, like maternal carrier screening, but this would be pregnant per pregnancy, not just one time. And let's see if you're at risk to develop preeclampsia. Oh my gosh, your blood level came back. You're at risk of preeclampsia. Okay, now, wouldn't we have known that maybe just by overall clinical risk factors? Well, that's unknown, right? Is this going to pick up more patients than clinical risk factors alone? We don't know that because we're not even there at the prediction of biomarkers to begin with. So that's the first question. But the bigger question is, okay, your labs came out jacked up. What does that mean? What am I going to give you? I mean, right? Wow, nothing like anxiety-producing results, because now we have a test that says you're at risk. But now we're just like watching a ticking time bomb. What prescription am I going to give you? So as we sit back, we're just watching and watching. What does that mean? Do we start an antihypertensive medication right off the bat? And there's no evidence for that. Yes, we're going to bring them back more frequently. That's likely, possibly home blood pressure monitoring. And of course, we've covered that data back and forth and the pros and cons of that. Or do we do serial monitoring? That's controversial as well, because yes, it is possible to find lab deterioration of preeclampsia, in other words, HELLP syndrome, just based on lab alone before they're clinically visible, like persistent hypertension. But that's not the majority. That does happen. It can happen up to anywhere from 5, some say as high as 10% of the time, where they'll have atypical HELLP, because remember, HELLP is a lab diagnosis. Hemolysis, elevated liver enzymes, low platelets. Typically, that falls under established persistent high blood pressure. But by definition, if you excluded other causes and they have hemolysis, elevated liver enzymes, low platelets, that's HELLP. And then you can make an action plan based on that. But the majority of people will only have lab abnormalities once they already have high persistent and deregulated blood pressure. So all to say is, once we find this test, what do we do about it? That's unclear. I want to make it known that I am very much in favor of these biomarkers. I think it's fascinating. It makes biological sense. It gives a way to attack or do targeted therapy. But nobody knows what to do with these when they predict potentially hypertensive disorders in pregnancy. And this is a little bit different than finding biomarkers for something like nausea, vomiting in a pregnancy or hyperemesis. Remember that we just recently focused on that in the last episode. Remember that we just recently covered this in our past episode. That was growth determining factor, or GDF number 15, and insulin-like factor binding protein number 7. And if you find those, you could give ideally a vaccine or targeted therapy to block that from rising. But this is likely a side effect of implantation. Well, how do we affect that? So a lot of questions remain, okay? And so this is one of the issues that we're dealing with. We're going to have a test, ideally, at some point, that can risk stratify who's at high risk. What if that test doesn't match up to clinical risk factors? And then what if we find it? What do we next do about it? These are the questions that remain. Oh, but wait, there's more. Here's the other issue. In AJOG, they just published this ahead of print. It hasn't officially come out yet in the regular gray journal, not the pink, under original research in obstetrics. And the title is Aspirin for Evidence-Based Preeclampsia Prevention Trial, Effects of Aspirin on Maternal Serum Pregnancy-Associated Plasma Protein A, that's PAP-A, and Placental Growth Factor Trajectories in Pregnancy. All right, just what we talked about. See, guys, this is making headlines. This is in print. Short of it is, this took a look at finding patients who had elevated values of serum PAP-A and PLGF, placental growth factor, saying, okay, hey, you're at risk. Okay, well, let's give you aspirin. And ideally then, if it's working, wouldn't it make sense that somehow those two biomarkers would go down, right? Well, that's unfortunately not what they showed. And let me just read you the conclusion. In other words, they're like, holy shit. We thought this was going to work, but the biomarkers didn't reduce. Now, this was just looking at lab values to see if those biomarkers went down. It didn't look at the effect, the clinical outcomes. It was just seeing if the thought is right. The hypothesis was giving aspirin is going to reset the thromboxane A2 prostaglandin pathway, right? And we're going to equal that out, that balance. But that's not what it showed. Their conclusion stated, quote, in women at increased risk of preterm preeclampsia, well, how do we know that? Because they had elevated biomarkers. Aspirin at 150 milligrams, so it was at the higher dose, had no significant effects on pregnancy-associated plasma protein A or placental growth factor trajectories when compared to placebo, end quote. In other words, yes, you still use it. If this test comes out bad, we're of course going to give them aspirin, but we're going to hope that the way that it prevents deterioration of blood pressure is by some other mechanism on the vascular wall and responsiveness versus just tracking these protein markers. So the paper didn't say not to use it. Okay, again, this is brand new article in press from the Gray Journal. It didn't say that we're not going to use aspirin. That's not the point. The point is we don't know how aspirin totally is going to do this, but we hope that it will. But that looking for effectiveness by looking at a reduction in those two specific biomarkers doesn't seem to be a thing. Okay. So yes, if you find out that this test is elevated, if that's the test, these two markers, PAP-A and PLGF, give them aspirin. But don't look for proof of efficacy based on a downtrend of these. Does that make sense? So there's clinical effect that's different, that's clinical expression, and then there's biomarker follow-up, like following a tumor marker after resection. Yes, after removing ovarian cancer, you track CA-125 because if it goes up, it could be a risk factor for recurrence, right? That's why you track it. But here, with hypertensive disorders, the data as of this publication seems to show that that's not how aspirin likely works. So if you have elevated PAP-A, PLGF, give them aspirin, great, walk away and just treat them like anybody else. Don't look for this to have a downward trajectory because based on this, quote, we found no evidence that aspirin affects these biomarkers' trajectories in pregnancy. It is unlikely that PAP-A and PLGF, they go on to say, will be useful to evaluate aspirin effects or guide the timing of aspirin discontinuation, end quote. So again, they didn't say not to use it. They just said it's hard to tell if we're going to use a biomarker to track its effectiveness, all right? Now, I do need to give a little disclosure here of this study because it was done a little oddly. This was the participants that were in a database called the Combined Multi-Marker Screening and Randomized Patient Treatment with Aspirin for Evidence-Based Preeclampsia Prevention Trial. Wow, I'm not going to say that again. That's the name of the database, the original trial, all right? And this looked at women at high risk of preterm preeclampsia who were identified in the first trimester. They received daily aspirin, again, 150, from the first trimester, here it is, to 36 weeks of gestation. Okay, so now we remember typically in typical practice, you use aspirin up until delivery. That used to be a thing that you stop at 36 weeks because you didn't want aspirin to affect bleeding. Now, ACOG says that's not a thing. You continue aspirin up until delivery. Y'all, hold on. We're going to take a little break in a minute, but I want to just show you. Listen to this. Listen to this. Look how controversial this whole thing is, okay? So we just talked about this this article ahead of print from the Gray Journal, American Journal of OBGYN, aspirin for evidence-based preeclampsia prevention trial, effects of aspirin on maternal serum, pregnancy-associated plasma protein A, and placental growth factor trajectories, right? So PAP-A and PLGF, they're like, hey, those trajectories didn't decrease. But in that trial that was published out of JAMA just exactly 1 year ago, actually, it was on February 21st, 2023, and we're taping this on February the 24th, 2024. That publication from JAMA last year that said we could probably stop aspirin at 24 to 28 weeks in pregnancies at high risk of preterm preeclampsia. This was an RCT. Look what they found. You talk about controversial. So let's put this in perspective. Look, take out your right hand. Look at your right hand. That's your right hand. On the right hand, it says, if you give aspirin, it's not going to have any effect on PAP-A and placental growth factor as in continuing aspirin to 36 weeks. Now, look at your left hand. On the left hand is this publication from exactly 1 year ago out of JAMA that said it's possibly okay to stop aspirin at 24 to 28 weeks, looking at other biomarkers. Here's what they stated. Quote, aspirin discontinuation at 24 to 28 weeks was non-inferior to aspirin continuation for preventing preterm preeclampsia in pregnant individuals at high risk of preeclampsia and a normal soluble-like tyrosine kinase 1 to placental growth factor ratio. All right, y'all, look how interesting this is. So this study, okay, that came out of JAMA, was out of different hospitals. It was 9 maternity hospitals in Spain, okay? Did you notice that? The lisp in Spain. I don't know. Look, my father was Spanish, so I get to say España, okay? I can turn on the lisp when I want to, man. It's crazy. I mean, vamos, vosotros vamos a la tienda. See, there it is. Oh, my goodness. So 9 maternity hospitals in Spain, but at baseline, the way that they recruited the patients is like they did a high-risk preeclampsia screening, okay? It was a screening algorithm. Now, this algorithm wasn't just the high-risk, 2 moderate risk factors or no risk factors like we use with ACOG. It was an algorithm, okay? The way that they assessed the risk of preeclampsia in the first trimester was this combination of maternal factors like age, BMI, race, ethnicity, parity, history of chronic hypertension. Do they have diabetes? Did they have preeclampsia in a previous pregnancy? They used MAP, mean arterial pressures. They used uterine artery pulsativity index, things that we don't do. And they used maternal serum pregnancy associated plasma protein A and placental growth factor. So they did have a baseline biomarker test, but it wasn't used independently. It was part of that algorithm. And if they failed that algorithm, then they got the 150 aspirin. Then they continued that, and then they started looking at changes in soluble-like tyrosine kinase compared to placental growth factor ratio. And if it was 38 or less between 24 and 28 weeks, they discontinued aspirin. Okay, and again, the rates of development of preeclampsia, they weren't equivalent, but they were non-inferior. Okay, so in other words, yes, some people who stopped it went on to develop preeclampsia compared to those who didn't, but it was not clinically or statistically different. It was a non-inferiority trial. So remember, non-inferior doesn't mean it was equivalent. It means it was close enough. All right, so there was a development of preeclampsia less than 1.9% compared to those who continued it. So it's not equivalent stopping aspirin between 24 and 28 in those who had normal soluble-like tyrosine kinase placental growth factor ratios, which is 38 or less. They developed preeclampsia at a non-inferior rate, not equivalent, non-inferior. So within 1.9% difference. So that's something to consider. Okay. So do you see how this is different? In the other study, it says PAP-A and placental growth factor didn't change trajectories. But in this, basically using the Thermos test, that's what Thermos was, the ratio between soluble-like tyrosine kinase 1 and placental growth factor at 38 as a discriminating factor. Under 38, it's like negative. Then they had a moderate group and then a severe group. I mean, it's like if it's over 80, he's like, man, your time, your wick on your time bomb is very, very small, okay? So that's another question. Here's the questions that we have. Which ratios should we use? Which biomarkers should we use? We don't have the answers to these. Do we do a baseline and then track this ratio later on, like with Thermos, even though Thermos was in those with established hypertensive disorder, looking to see who would decompensate? We don't know. Is that an exciting, guys? It really should be exciting to you, because it is to me, that we have all of this world of possibility for the development of future interventions for hypertensive disorders, and we are at that cusp. And guys, that's not even what we were supposed to be talking about. The focus of this episode isn't biomarkers. It is, should we be using the stage one classification of hypertension in pregnancy, like AHA? Should we all be uniform? That's what we're going to tackle next. The short answer, let's just get to it, because we're running out of time here, is no. Now, are women with stage one hypertension in pregnancy, I've been seeing my internist, my other gynecologist, my family medicine practitioner, whatever, they told me I had stage one hypertension and now I'm pregnant. What do I do? That's the question that we're going to ask, and they're going to ask you on the oral boards. And the short answer is, oh, you've got risk factors for some issues. And I'll tell you what those issues are. Two are maternal, two are fetal. Oh, hell, let me just tell you now and then we'll take a break. The two maternal are, that could put you at a higher risk for development of hypertensive disorder pregnancy. That could put you at risk because of the physiological stress to your body and oxidative stress with gestational diabetes. Those are the two risk factors on your side. And for the baby, it could raise your risk of both spontaneous and induced preterm labor and potentially of NICU admissions. All right, so that's the four things. It could put them at risk of true hypertensive disorders, GDM, and it could increase the risk of spontaneous or induced preterm birth and increase the risk of NICU admission. But that's the last one, NICU admission, is a little controversial because not all studies showed that. The question is, what do we do with that? Well, outside of giving you aspirin, nothing much. Right now, the data does not favor putting you at antepartum surveillance. It does not favor giving you antihypertensive medication. It does favor keeping an eye on you, maybe doing home blood pressure monitoring. But do we need to induce patients with stage one hypertension at 38 weeks or 37 weeks? We don't know. So that's the answer. Right now, we are using 140 overnight. We are using stage two hypertension in pregnancy as the highest predictor of adverse outcomes regarding hypertensive disorders in pregnancy. And that is data-driven. There's been data that has looked at, and yes, the risk of getting something wrong with hypertension goes up in a linear fashion the worse your blood pressure is. But based on the data, the only one that can actually risk stratify and risk stratify well is using that cutoff of 140 over 90. Well, now that I've already let the cat out of the bag, and if you notice, I said it that way because I gave you the history of that cat out of the bag in our last episode. Why don't we take a little break? Let's take a breather. I need to refresh my coffee, and then I'll tell you about this new publication from Rebecca Horrigan, as well as Baha Sabai and George Saad on stage one chronic hypertension and pregnancy out of the AJOG-MFM. In this clinical expert review, the authors summarize the data beautifully here and is an exact echo of what ACOG said in 2019 in his practice bulletin. But let me read this to you exactly for sake of time. Quote, although a stepwise relationship between the American College of Cardiology and American Heart Association blood pressure category and risk of preeclampsia exists, systolic blood pressure measurements less than 120 and overall blood pressure measurements less than 130 over 80 and even less than 140 over 90, so there it is, so that's from normal, elevated, and stage one hypertension, listen to what they say, quote, all demonstrated negative likelihood ratios of greater than 0.2. What that means is they're terrible at prediction. They go on to say, quote, therefore, they are not useful to rule out the development of preeclampsia. Listen to this, guys. Quote, blood pressure measurement of 140 over 90 or more was the only useful predictor for the development of preeclampsia with a positive likelihood ratio of 5.95. And thus, these authors conclude that the current definition of chronic hypertension in pregnancy should not be revised, end quote. So, should we be using stage 1 hypertension to define hypertensive disorder? No, not in pregnancy. However, that doesn't mean we ignore it. So, here's a catch, guys. Remember those four things, two maternal, two neonatal. If you're asked on the oral boards, what do we do with 130 over 80s stage 1 hypertension in pregnancy? The answer is, that is a great question, because they are at risk for things, including development of gestational hypertension and hypertensive disorders. They are at risk of gestational diabetes. They are at risk of spontaneous or induced preterm birth and potentially NICU admissions. However, we don't know what to do with that yet. As of right now, there is no data that antepartum fetal surveillance in stage 1 hypertension improves outcome. There is no data that that reduces stillbirth in patients with that blood pressure range. The only thing that's required as of right now, as far as we know, is the use of aspirin. So if you have a patient who has zero risk factors according to ACOG's risk stratification for preeclampsia development, but they do have stage 1 hypertension, that is a potential flag, and they need to start aspirin at that time. Now, should it be 81 or 150? I favor the 150. Most of the data shows that that is beneficial, but the point is, start them on something. As these authors of this expert review state, quote, until evidence of a favorable benefit-to-risk ratio to support application of the new guidelines to pregnant patients becomes available, we recommend continuing the use of traditional blood pressure cutoffs and guidelines for pregnant patients. The only reasonable change from prior guidelines will be to consider the use of low-dose aspirin in patients with stage 1 hypertension, given that there is some evidence suggesting that it decreases the risk of preeclampsia among this patient population, end quote. And remember, podcast family, just to be clear, out of ACOG's practice advisory from December 2021 on low-dose aspirin use for the prevention of preeclampsia and related morbidity and mortality, it does state that. I mean, it's in its high-risk category, chronic hypertension. The question is, well, what should that chronic hypertension be? Is it stage 2 or stage 1? Based on the evidence right now, interpretation of ACOG's risk stratification for aspirin, again from December 2021, that chronic hypertension should be stage 1 hypertension. Not elevated, but 130s over 80s. So when do you start low-dose aspirin? Well, if the patient right now, if you're doing risk stratification and not doing universal, which is its own separate issue, as we've already discussed, then chronic hypertension, defined as stage 1 hypertension, that indeed includes aspirin identification as a high-risk category. Remember that ACOG changed the moderate risk factors to include in vitro fertilization because of the increased risk in that patient population as well. So this is from the practice advisory from December 2021, which was the last one that was done. There's been a lot of stuff on aspirin, including ACOG's new working document that's not out yet, that is updating some of the guidance for this, all right, addressing universal versus risk-based classification. So should we be starting these patients on aspirin? Absolutely. It's already an ACOG's high-risk factor. But that is, to be very clear, that should be interpreted as stage 1 hypertension from the AHA. This is basically the same sentiment that was in ACOG's Practice Bulletin 203, Chronic Hypertension in Pregnancy from 2019, that discusses the 2017 AHA rules. But it also brings up the same questions that we just discussed. Quote, it is not clear what should be done with a patient without a prior formal diagnosis of chronic hypertension, but who now is found to have stage 1 hypertension range blood pressures in pregnancy before 20 weeks. Based on this recommendation in this practice bulletin, this would not require initiation of antihypertensive medication. However, a conservative approach of a higher degree of observation may be warranted, end quote. So, if they come in and they're already on medication, I mean, do we take them off? Do we leave it on? That we don't know. There's no formal guidance for that. Because remember, the CHIP and the CHAP trial both say maintain blood pressure to a target of 140 over 90, not 130s over 80s. So if they're already on it, do we leave them on or off? That depends on other risk factors like age, BMI, past history of preeclampsia, all of those things can be taken into account. But to say right now, if a patient comes into pregnancy with an established diagnosis of stage 1 hypertension on antihypertensive meds, to say carte blanche, oh, we're going to take them off meds. Wait a minute, that needs individualization of care. And just the opposite, if they come in with stage 1 hypertension to go, oh, AHA says that's bad, we're going to start you on medication. You can't do that either. It requires individualization of care as far as we know. So what to do with stage 1 hypertension coming into a new pregnancy? Individualization of care. Don't start them on medication if they're not already on it, but do treat to that 140 over 90 target range. Remember, that's CHIP and CHAP. Maybe keep them on regular surveillance. Don't go just loosey-goosey on the new, loosened criteria of visits based on low risk, because they are not low risk. Stage 1 hypertension should be considered a high-risk condition going into pregnancy. So it doesn't require antepartum surveillance as of right now, doesn't require early delivery as of right now, and 130s over 80s does not require medication treatment. However, the use of biomarkers is evolving and one day may play a vital part in not only the diagnosis, but obviously the management of hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. All right, podcast family, that brings us to a wrap. If you can believe it, in this episode, we have reviewed 9 separate pieces of publication and literature. 9. That's what we're doing here. Guys, it takes a lot of work to put these things together. We put this data together as if we're doing a legal brief going to court. We want the evidence to be strong and sturdy and to meet the test of time. So I hope you found this helpful. As always, we're thankful for you. We're glad you're part of our podcast community, and we'll see you on another episode of Clinical Pearls.